Well, turn with me this morning to Genesis 29. Genesis chapter 29, where we'll be reading the entire chapter, as well as the first half of chapter 30. As I've been doing up to this point, I'm going to be making whatever commentary is necessary as we read. So let's just begin at Genesis 29, verse 1. Moses writes, "Then Jacob went on his journey and came to the land of the sons of the east. He looked and saw a well in the field, and behold, three flocks of sheep were lying there beside it, for from that well they watered the flocks. Now the stone on the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks were gathered there, they would then roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep, and put the stone back in its place on the mouth of the well. Jacob said to them, 'My brothers, where are you from?' And they said, 'We are from Haran.' He said to them, 'Do you know Laban, the son of Nahor?' And they said, 'We know him.' And he said to them, 'Is it well with him?' And they said, 'It is well. And here is Rachel, his daughter, coming with the sheep.' He said, 'Behold, it is still high day. It's not time for the livestock to be gathered. Water the sheep and go pasture them.' But they said, 'We cannot until all the flocks are gathered.' And they rolled the stone from the mouth of the well. Then we water the sheep." While he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. When Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, Jacob went up and rolled the stone from the mouth of the well and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted his voice and wept." Let's just stop there. That's a really strange reaction. I was sharing with some of you earlier that this either means something fairly profound or Rachel was just not that good a kisser. Okay, it's not as funny as I thought it'd be. Why would Jacob weep after having kissed Rachel? Well, again, we can see this fairly clearly. He'd been on a long journey, an arduous journey. He was really unsure whether he would survive the journey. It was that dangerous. And so, as we all do when we get to our destination, he was probably just overwhelmed with gratitude that he had finally arrived, that he had finally met up with the family of his mother. And so he was probably overwhelmed with gratitude for the Lord's bringing him safely to his relatives. Now, more specifically, I genuinely believe that he was also thankful for God's providentially bringing Rachel into his life. And Jacob wasn't the only one happy about this, was he? Keep reading at verse 12. "Jacob told Rachel that he was a relative of her father and that he was Rebekah's son. And she ran and told her father. So when Laban heard the news of Jacob, his sister's son, he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him and brought him into his house. And he related to Laban all these things. Laban said to him, 'Surely you are my bone and my flesh.' And he stayed with him a month. Then Laban said to Jacob, 'Because you are my relative, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me, what shall your wages be?' Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah. The name of the younger was Rachel. And Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was beautiful of form and face." Now, what does Moses mean when he says that Leah's eyes were weak? Well, according to some translations, there was no sparkle in her eyes. There was no life in her eyes. She was probably either sickly, or this could be another way of Moses relating to us that in comparison to Rachel, Leah was rather plain. There was really nothing notable about her. Some commentators have suggested that maybe she had a lazy eye, maybe her eye color was dull. There's several possibilities here. But I really do think that what Moses is trying to convey is that while Rachel was beautiful of form and face, Leah was neither of those things. Now understand, Moses isn't saying that Leah was ugly. He's simply saying that by way of comparison, she was probably much more plain. Whatever the case, it's clear that Jacob wanted to take Rachel for his wife. Verse 18. Now Jacob loved Rachel. So he said, I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter Rachel. Laban said, it's better that I give her to you than to give her to another man. Stay with me. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed to him but a few days because of his love for her. And we need to understand something really important about what's going on here. When Jacob offered 7 years of service for Rachel's hand in marriage, most scholars who are familiar with how business transactions were conducted during this particular time among this particular group of people, most scholars agree that when Jacob made this offer, he was making an extravagant offer. In other words, when he made this offer, according to custom, Laban should have come back and said, no, that's way too generous. Work for me for 3 years. And then Jacob could have come back and said, yeah, 3 years, that's still quite a long time. How about a year? So normally, this type of transaction would have involved a lot of back and forth. But what does Laban do? He says, okay, give me 7 years then. And oh, by the way, just to show what kind of person Laban was, Laban's not a nice guy here. Laban is taking full advantage of his own family. And so when Laban holds him to this 7 years, the reason Jacob mentioned 7 years is because 7 years was the minimum amount of time that a slave was expected to serve his master. And so he's stepping out on a limb. He's saying, I'll serve you like a slave for Rachel's hand. And Laban's like, okay. Now, it doesn't end there either, does it? Jacob, in his mind, didn't really mind because Moses says it seemed to him but a few days because of his love for her. He's a sappy music there, right? So all he has to do is serve 7 years and he's on his way, right? No. Verse 21. After this 7 years, Jacob's time of servitude has run its course. Then Jacob said to Laban, give me my wife, for my time is complete, that I may go into her. Laban gathered all the men of the place and made a feast. Now in the evening he took his daughter Leah and brought her to him, and Jacob went into her. Laban also gave his maid Zilpah to his daughter Leah as a maid. So it came about in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. Now we can't help but borrow a line from R.C. Sproul. When it comes to how these people act, what's wrong with you people? This is a freaky sort of thing. Laban says, yes, Jacob, you can have my daughter Rachel. It's dark, no lighting in the tent. Jacob goes in to consummate this marriage, wakes up the next morning, and it's Leah. To say that's problematic is an understatement. Jacob says to Laban, what is this you've done to me? Was it not for Rachel that I served you? Why then have you deceived me? Apparently, at least in Laban's mind, Jacob had not asked the right questions 7 years earlier. He hadn't read the fine print. He couldn't read Laban's mind, but Laban was actually up to no good. And before you begin to feel sorry for Jacob here, I want you to think very carefully about the grand irony in all this. I think this is rich with irony. And I think this is God's way of chastising Jacob. To hear from Jacob's lips, "Why have you deceived me?" is fairly comical. After all, what had Jacob done to his own father? What had Jacob done to his own brother? Jacob's name was deceiver. And he's asking Laban, "Why have you deceived me?" Huh? Yeah, why did you Jacob me? I'm Jacob. Nobody can out-Jacob Jacob. You just out-Jacobed me. That's very good. Now, it's not only rich in irony, but again, I think it's a crystal clear example of God's chastisement for Jacob's own deception. And the chastisement doesn't end there either. Look at verse 26. "But Laban said, 'It is not the practice in our place to marry off the younger before the firstborn.'" Well, duh, you could have said that beforehand. We might have made another arrangement. I mean, we are living in the days of polygamy, and it would have been perfectly acceptable for Jacob to take both of them, preferring one over the other naturally. But Laban waits until this point to say, "Oh, by the way, it's actually a practice here in this country to marry off the younger before the firstborn." He says, "Complete the week of this one," that is Leah. This is a reference to what is known as the bridal week, when you're married, as they were the moment the marriage was consummated. Whether he agreed to marry Leah or not was immaterial at this point. But it was customary to celebrate for a week. And to do otherwise might have actually even cost Jacob his life. It was that serious. You didn't do anything to interrupt the bride's week. The men, the brothers especially, would not have stood for that. And so Laban, knowing this, says, "Complete the week of this one." And again, for Jacob to have done it otherwise would have been dangerous. And he says, "And then we'll give you the other also." Now Rachel's not the primary wife. Now Rachel's going to be the bonus wife. "Complete Leah's week and we'll give you the other one also for the service which you shall serve with me for another 7 years." Jacob did so. He completed her week. Laban gave him his daughter Rachel as his wife. Laban also gave his maid Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as her maid. So Jacob went into Rachel also, and indeed he loved Rachel more than Leah, and he served with Laban for another 7 years. Now note really carefully what happens next, because yet again we can see God's providence in action. Verse 31. "Now the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, and he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. Leah conceived and bore a son and named him Reuben. For she said, 'Because the Lord has seen my affliction, surely now my husband will love me.' Then she conceived again and bore a son and said, 'Because the Lord has heard that I am unloved, he has therefore given me this son also.' So she named him Simeon. She conceived again and bore a son and said, 'Now this time my husband will become attached to me because I have borne him 3 sons. Therefore his name was Levi. And she conceived again and bore a son and said, 'This time I will praise the Lord.' Therefore she named him Judah." Then she stopped there. Once again, this is fairly straightforward, at least on the surface. But it's what's going on beneath the surface that's really fascinating here. While Rachel was barren, Jacob's chosen, Jacob's favorite, while Rachel was barren, Leah had 4 sons in rapid succession. And with each son came the hope that Jacob would finally love her. Now, did that ever happen? No, not really. Not that we're ever told. Jacob continued to love Rachel in spite of Leah's ability to give him sons. But here's another critical point of irony that shouldn't go unnoticed. We've seen God on several occasions already overturning the natural order of things, right? We've seen God, namely, in this whole episode between Jacob and Esau. Before either of the twins had been born, before either had done good or bad, it was determined by God that the older would serve the younger. Matter of fact, Jacob's deception was also foretold and realized when they came out of the womb. Esau came first and Jacob had a hold of his heel as if to bring him back so that he might be born first. And then from that point forward, Jacob's whole life, although we're not told all the details, we have to assume that Jacob's entire life was one of deception. He was always trying to vie for the upper hand. He was always trying to earn the birthright. And at least he was smart enough to do one thing. He was smart enough to stay close to his mother because he realized just how much power and influence mothers have. And as it turned out, his mother became his partner in crime. And together they deceived Isaac. And so we can see God overturning the natural order of things, even using the sinful acts of those who were involved. Jacob would be the inheritor of all his father's blessings. It would come about as God had said. Well, the Lord's doing something very similar here. It's very interesting. Jacob loved Rachel, as we said, and he had little regard for Leah, really. There's not even a hint in this entire narrative that Jacob ever prayed seeking God's wisdom. Now, don't you find that kind of strange? Everywhere else where we find decisions being made among the patriarchs, those decisions are always bathed in prayer. Not so with Jacob. There's no indication. Jacob, being the typical man in many respects, shows up at the well. The first attractive young woman to show up, that's the one. He's going entirely off of his flesh. He doesn't pause and say, Lord, is this the one? He doesn't do as Abraham's servant did in the case of bringing Isaac a wife. He doesn't seek the Lord's face. He doesn't say, okay, I'm going to throw this fleece out there and say, the one that you have for Isaac will be the one that comes up to me and offers to water my camels and so on and so forth. He didn't do any of that. He cuts right to the chase. He sees Rachel, who, again, by Moses' own testimony, was beautiful in form and of face. And that's enough to convince him that she's going to be my wife. By all accounts, Jacob was smitten, not by an overwhelming sense that God had given Rachel to him, but because she was pretty. And Leah was plain. And yet, understand this. The seed, singular, the seed of Abraham would not come from Jacob's choice of a wife. The seed of Abraham would come from Leah. Once again, God overturning the natural order of things. We would think, here's this great patriarch Jacob. He picks a wife for himself, well and good. And then from her and Jacob's union comes the seed, Jesus. But we don't see that at all, do we? Instead, we see the one not preferred. We see the one that was relegated to a position of far lesser importance in Jacob's mind. We see the plain Jane, as it were, becoming the mother of Judah, from which the seed would come. And again, if you don't see the irony there, you're missing the whole point. What is the point? The point is, as we've made this point several times already, God is going to do what God does in spite of what you think, in spite of what you wish, in spite of how hard you work for the contrary. God's will be done. Isn't that comforting? It's especially comforting because I know I'm a lot like Jacob in a lot of ways. I do things impulsively. I do things impetuously. I do things according to the flesh fairly often. And yet the Lord is gentle. The Lord is loving. The Lord is caring, because every time he has to whack me on the head really good to get me back on the track. But most of the time, how does the Lord do this? He deals with us as a mother deals with a toddler who's just learned to walk, right? What do? You walk behind them and you kind of give them gentle corrections. No, don't go there. Don't go there. Have you ever thought of God in that way? How He gently leads us? You know, we see the first shiny thing that would take us off the path, and what do? We start making a beeline for it. And God puts us back. No, go that way. God's doing this in spite of Jacob. God's doing this because the prophecy said in Isaac, your seed shall be named. And God was going to make good on that. Come what may. You think Leah was just kind of an add-on? You think Leah was just an afterthought by God? No, Leah was the main thing. Without her, we wouldn't have the Messiah. Now, there's something else here. Speaking of Leah being lesser in beauty and certainly lesser in Jacob's mind, she was nonetheless a great woman of God. How do we know? Well, we can see this in the birth of each of her sons. When Reuben is born, she says, because Jehovah, that's what's translated in caps in your Bible translation, the Lord, because Jehovah has seen my affliction, going to name my son this. When Simeon is born, she says, because Jehovah, once again, she attributes the birth of these children to the Lord Himself, Jehovah, the covenant name of God. What does that indicate? It indicates that she understands God to be the God of the covenant. She understands, even at odds with her own father, she understands that this is the one true God, to whom I owe all thanks for giving me these children. What about Rachel? When Rachel has children, not only are the first two, Dan and Naphtali, not only are those first two not actually her children at all, but her thanks to the Lord is tepid at best. By way of application, for you young people who are not yet married, the lesson here is clear, isn't it? You young people, hear me well. Life isn't as simple as meeting someone, deciding that you like everything about them externally, and then deciding that you'd like to spend the rest of your life with them. That's a lesson that some people have to learn the hard way. Right? You ever heard the expression, beauty's only skin deep? It's so true. This is why the Lord prefers women who are adorned inwardly as to those who make a big deal of being adorned outwardly. Beauty fades. that trophy wife that you might see yourself attaching yourself to, that raving beauty that you have in your mind as God's selection of a wife for you, get that out of your mind. Now, it might happen that you marry a beautiful woman. It may. But young men, what do you seek above all else? You don't seek a woman who looks good on the outside. You seek a woman after God's own heart. You seek a woman who loves the Lord her God with all her heart, soul, strength, and mind. Because I guarantee you, see, while beauty fades, that will never fade. And if you're looking for a permanent, lifelong relationship, you've got to realize that both of you, at some point, if you don't become fat and ugly, you're going to become fat or ugly. It's true. Second law of thermodynamics, entropy has a dramatic effect on all of us. Gravity will catch up with you in terms of not your weight exclusively, but wrinkles set in, faces start to droop, hair changes color. What we used to be able to do on a moment's notice, now it takes us 24 hours to prepare for, if we can do it at all. You get the picture here. Young people, marry someone that the Lord brings to you. Don't simply fly off on your own emotions, your own fleshly likes and dislikes. Now, those are important. Don't get me wrong. They are. And God does have someone for everyone. He does. But wait upon the Lord. Don't be impulsive. Don't react the way Jacob reacted when he saw Rachel. Because I guarantee you, Jacob himself would have been much happier in life, as we'll see going forward. He would have been much happier in life with Leah as his wife, had he only appealed not to his fleshly impulses, but appealed to the Lord and asked the Lord, Lord, who is it that you have for me? Here's the thing, and most respectable commentators agree, that if Jacob had asked that question, the Lord would have brought Leah to him. And we can see it working out in the blessings. Rachel, again, doesn't really give much credit to God. Besides, I mean, why should she? These are not her children. Dan and Naphtali are not hers. They're the children given to her by these maids of hers. Now, let's see if we can learn a little more about Rachel. Go to chapter 30, verse 1. What was Rachel's reaction when she herself could not bear children for Jacob? Well, now when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, she became jealous of her sister. And she said to Jacob, give me children or else I die. You know, we're told here that Jacob's anger burned against Rachel, and he said, am I in the place of God, who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb? Folks, there's no other way to put this. Jacob's basically telling his wife, Rachel, the problem's not mine, it's yours. I have demonstrated my virility. I've had children by your sister. Am I God? Am I the one that's in control of the womb? Am I the one who makes the decision as to whether or not you are to have children? And what does she do? She does what any thoughtless, jealous person might do. She said, here's my maid, Bilhah. What? Rachel, if you were that concerned with having children of your own, if you were a God-fearing woman like your sister, what would she have done? She would have said, can we at least pray about this? Let us now go and seek the face of the Lord. Let us now fast and pray that the Lord might open my womb as well. She doesn't do that. What does she do? She resorts again to her own carnality. She says, here's my maid, Bilhah. Go into her that she may bear on my knees, that through her I too may have children. Now, this bearing on the knees, common practice back then, it can mean a couple of things, but most conservative commentators mean that Rachel would have been there when the child was born, almost like a midwife. They would arrange themselves to where when the baby was being born, Bilhah would have been there probably with her arms over her knees. And that was symbolic, purely symbolic, of Rachel having a child herself. Like a proxy birth. Although God didn't recognize that. Whose child is it going to be when it's born? It's going to be Jacob and Bilhah's child. It's not going to be Rachel's child. There's nothing that you could do actually to correct that situation. Rachel thought you could. She thought that tradition would be enough to convince others that now Rachel has a child too. No. No. So she gave him her maid Bilhah as a wife, and Jacob went into her. Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. Then Rachel said, God has vindicated me. He has indeed heard my voice and has given me a son. Clueless? Maybe? She doesn't get it. No, God has given a son to Jacob's third wife. Do we not read here? She gave him her maid Bilhah as a wife. Therefore she named him Dan. Rachel's maid Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. So Rachel said, with mighty wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister and I have indeed prevailed. What did you do? You can only imagine the anger that was present in this poor maid who was having to bear Rachel's children that Rachel would then call her own. She named him Naphtali. When Leah saw that she had stopped bearing, she took her maid Zilpah and gave her to Jacob as a wife. Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a son. Then Leah said, how fortunate. So she named him Gad. Notice that she doesn't thank Jehovah for this child. She has, I think, more of an appropriate response, doesn't she? It's almost her way of saying to her maid Zilpah, I've stopped bearing. Congratulations. You now have a child. It's a child added to the family, yes, but that's why she said, how fortunate. So she named him Gad. Leah's maid Zilpah bore a second son. Then Leah said, praise Jehovah? No. Happy am I, for women will call me happy. So she named him Asher. And I think we need to pause here and take a breath or two because there's a lot going on here. First thing I want to say is that this type of arrangement was tolerated by God, not necessarily mandated by God. These are the times of ignorance that we're told later on that God overlooked when man did seem to take things into his own hands. Bear in mind, they don't have the law yet. Bear in mind, they don't have any inscripturated word. They're kind of flying by the seat of their pants religiously. They don't really understand much at all about God's revelation. So far, God has revealed himself only in small snippets through those men deemed prophets and patriarchs. He's done more of personal revelation than he has corporate revelation. And so we can understand they're simply acting in tribal ways, traditional ways. We need not look at all of this as normative, but formative. These are those early years where In order to keep the bloodline pure, it was not uncommon to marry your cousin and have children with your cousins and so on and so forth. Once the population reached a large enough size and the revelation coming from God was made much clearer with regard to these things, those things start tapering off, right? The gene pool expands and everything is set for future generations. This is really kind of a soap opera situation. Thus far, Jacob has fathered 8 sons, 4 by his unloved wife Leah, and 2 each by Rachel's maids, Bilhah and Zilpah. Actually, Leah's maid was Zilpah, but nevertheless, he's fathered these sons. And in verses 14 and 15, the drama between Rachel and Leah only intensifies. Read it with me. Now in the days of wheat harvest, Reuben went out and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother Leah. Then Rachel said to Leah, "Please give me some of your son's mandrakes." But she said to her, "Is it a small matter for you to take my husband? And would you take my son's mandrakes also?" So Rachel said, "Therefore, he may lie with you tonight in return for your son's mandrakes." Again, this is like, kind of like another exhibition of just how far Rachel was from the one true God. You know, we're going to see a little bit later, as further proof of Rachel's distance from Jehovah God, what did she do when she and Jacob were finally allowed to leave? She took all of his idols. Why? To be vindictive? No. She took those idols because she herself was an idol worshiper. Again, further proof that Rachel's really kind of up to no good. You know, Rachel's really not, and I don't know how you grew up understanding who Rachel was, but I have to be honest, I had a lot more favorable view of Rachel last week than I did this week. Well, you know, because we read these Bible stories, and, you know, most of the stories just tell us the simple fact, you know, Jacob married Rachel, and Rachel was loved by him, and they spent, you know, 7 years with him as a slave to her father, and it didn't seem like that long because, oh, they just loved each other so much, and we get this little flannel graph image in our mind, and we're thinking, wow, things were great. This Rachel, man, she was great. You might have even questioned God at times. God, why did you shut Rachel's womb? But again, if you slow down and start to look at all the details, it's like, now we know. Now we know why it was actually Leah who God intended to use to bring about his seed. And here's the real blessing in all this. It's not as though these other children born were of no use to God. They were. Did you count how many sons have been born yet? Up to this point, keep counting. Let me just say this, though. Anybody know what a mandrake is? Probably not. A mandrake, like a little fruit that comes off of an herb. It's a fruit that looks almost like a persimmon or a small yellow apple. Mandrakes were used for their hallucinogenic properties. They were also used for medicinal reasons. But they were used much in the same way that Native Americans used peyote. They were used by idol worshippers to conjure up spirits, to create, you know, hallucinogenic trips, and so on and so forth. I'm not going to throw Rachel entirely under the bus here by saying that, you know, she was that far gone. I think probably they used them for medicinal purposes. At least that's what I'd like to think. So we'll just leave that. They could also be very poisonous. They're a member of the nightshade family, if you know what nightshade is. Very poisonous, and if used incorrectly, you can kill somebody really quickly with these mandrakes. Anyway, verse 16. When Jacob came in from the field in the evening, then Leah went out to meet him and said, "You must come in to me, for I have surely hired you with my son's mandrakes." I'm not going to make the comment I wanted to make on that. Just use your imagination. I mean, that's just not right. But at the same time, it does cause us to feel a little bit sorry for Leah, does it not? She's wanting so badly to be loved by Jacob that she would even barter for a night with him. So he lay with her that night. God gave heed to Leah. You understand that? God gave heed to Leah. He didn't chastise her for this bartering arrangement. He didn't upbraid her for having made this kind of deal. He blessed her. She conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. Then Leah said, "God has given me my wages because I gave my maid to my husband." So she named him Issachar. Leah conceived again and bore a sixth son to Jacob. Then Leah said, "God has endowed me with a good gift. Now my husband will dwell with me because I have borne him six sons." So she named him Zebulun. Afterward, she bore a son and bore a daughter and named her Dinah. Then God remembered Rachel, and God gave heed to her and opened her womb. So she conceived finally and bore a son and said, "God has taken away my reproach." Finally. You see her response now? God has done this for me. He's taken away my reproach. I think she finally put two and two together. She finally used her logical faculties to conclude that the reason she had been barren all this time was because of her own conniving, because of her own sinful attitude. "God has taken away my reproach." She named him Joseph. And we all know how that turns out, right? What a blessing. What a blessing. In spite of who she is and what she's done and the attitude that she's portrayed, God gives her a son. Not only a son, He gives her Joseph. She named him Joseph, saying, "May the Lord give me another son." And God would, in fact, give Rachel another son. Over in chapter 35, we'll see the birth of Rachel's last son, Benjamin, which brings Jacob's number of sons to 12. And who would they become? They'd become the 12 tribes of Israel. In spite of Rachel's attitude and actions, in spite of the fact that Jacob loved her more than he loved Leah, God's will be done. And Israel, Jacob would be renamed to Israel, and his 12 sons would be the heads of the 12 tribes that are named accordingly. Reuben, Simeon, Ephraim, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, Manasseh, and the smallest of them all, Benjamin.